With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast, a member of the Agora Podcast Network. I'm your host, Heather Tesco, and I'm a storyteller who makes history accessible because I believe it's a pathway to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, and having a deeper connection to our own humanity. This is episode 93. It's another joint episode with Melita Thomas from Tudor Times on Catherine Parr. She is a much requested queen for us to cover. You know how I mentioned the Agora Podcast Network? Well, we produce independent podcasts for people who are smart, discerning, and better looking than the average bear. And we have just under 1 million downloads a month. If this sounds like an audience that you would like to reach, contact us at agorapodcastnetwork.com about advertising your product or service. And now I want to thank the lovely patrons of this show who help to keep it independent. Thank you to Kathy, Cynthia, Jurgen, Olivia, Al, Ashley, Kendra, Anne Boleyn, aka Jessica, Elizabeth, another Cynthia, and Judith. Also Kaylee, Ian, Laura, Barbara, Shar, Kiva, Amy, Allison, Joanna, Kathy, Christine, Annetta, Catherine, Candace, Rebecca, and Shandor. You are all awesome, and I am so, so grateful to you. To learn more about how you can join this list of amazing people, you can go to patreon.com/englandcast. Patreon.com/englandcast, or you can go to englandcast.com and click on the donate and support area. So now let me introduce you to Melita Thomas. Melita is a co-founder and editor of Tudor Times, a website devoted to Tudor and Stuart history in the period from 1485 to 1625. You can find it at tudortimes.co.uk. She is also the author of a recently published book on Mary I, called The King's Pearl, so check that out too. Melita, who has always been fascinated by history ever since she saw the 1970s series Elizabeth R with Glenda Jackson, also contributes articles to BBC History Extra and Britain Magazine.
So she was your person of the month. She was your first person of the month, right?
She was, yes. Yeah, no, we had quite a lot of thought when we first decided to do it, and we wanted to look at somebody who was well enough known for people to be interested, but actually people didn't necessarily know that much about, or perhaps had a fairly fixed view of, you know, the whole idea that Catherine Parr was practically Henry's nursemaid has, you know, it's been very much debunked by new scholarship, but it's still in the popular imagination. That's kind of where she was. So we thought she would be a great one to do. And she's still one of my favourites, actually, of the people of the month that we've done, because I don't know, she seems to have had a really engaging personality, and I mean, some of her spiritual writings are a bit dense, shall we say, but she was interested in dancing and music, and she had family and friends, and yeah, she just seems like an attractive personality.
So what can you tell me about her early life before she became Henry's wife? And then I want to ask you about her relationship with Thomas Seymour as well. Mm-hmm. What can you tell me about her kind of early life with her first marriages and her early childhood and everything?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the interesting things about Catherine is that she's the only one of Henry's wives who had a life outside the court. I mean, Jane Seymour did to an extent, but she was a lady in waiting or a maid of honour quite young. So Catherine Parr, her parents, Maud Green, Lady Parr, was her mother, and her father, Sir Thomas, they were both members of the court. Maud was a lady in waiting to Queen Catherine of Aragon, and Sir Thomas Parr undertook quite a lot of diplomatic work for Henry. He was in the, can't remember if he was a privy councillor, but he was certainly in the Henry's sort of circle of advisors, although the Parrs were an old Yorkist family. But Catherine had a younger brother and a younger sister, Anne and William, and her father died when she was quite young. And unusually, her mother, although she was still very young, still only in her early 20s, I think, she didn't remarry, but she brought up her children with the help of her brother-in-law, Sir William Parr of Horton, and quite a lot of advice from a distant cousin who was Cuthbert Tunstall, the later Bishop of Durham. So interesting, actually, because Cuthbert Tunstall was a, you know, conservative in religion, but he was also a friend of Catherine's and clearly took a sort of fatherly role in her life. Maud's main job was to arrange the marriage of her son and heir, William. But her sort of subsidiary job was to arrange marriages for her daughters. And with Catherine, she arranged a marriage in 1528, when Catherine was about 14, to Edward Burgh of Gainsborough. And it used to be thought that this was a terribly old man, and Catherine, at the age of 14, was married to some old man and sent to live in the country. New research has showed that it wasn't the old Sir Edward Burgh, but his grandson, the young Edward, though they were probably of a similar sort of age, in their teens. We've no idea what they thought about each other. They had no children. Catherine, first of all, went to live with his family at Gainsborough Hall, which is actually well worth visiting. It's still there, just north of Lincoln, preserved by the local authority, in fact, right in the centre of the town of Gainsborough. Lovely old house. Sir Thomas Burgh was quite a strong personality. He dominated his children and probably Catherine as well. Horrible to his other daughter-in-law, who he threw out of the house bag and baggage because he thought she'd committed adultery. He was also a religious reformer and became chamberlain to Queen Anne Boleyn. So it's possible that Catherine was influenced by her father-in-law in her religious views, because she was only young. But then she and her husband, they had a home a bit north of Gainsborough at Kersey in Linton, I think, a little town north of Gainsborough. But young Edward died when I think Catherine was still in her teens, late teens by then. So she would have been getting on for 20. And nobody's quite sure where she went next, but probably she went to stay with her distant cousin, Catherine Strickland, or whose maiden name was Neville, but who had been one time married into the Burgh family, but was now remarried and re-widowed and living in Strickland in Kendal, in the rather lovely Sizer Castle, which is another place which is well worth visiting. So it's possible, or even probable, that Catherine was there for a short period, but she then remarried. And her second husband was John Neville, another of the great Neville family who were everywhere. He was Lord Latimer, and he was probably 20 years older than Catherine. She was his third wife, and he already had a son and a daughter. And she became quite a devoted stepmother to her stepdaughter, Margaret, possibly less close to her stepson. And there's a couple of quotes where she's talking about, and they didn't use the word teenagers in those days, but about young people taking slights everywhere and being difficult and morose and sullen. And you can think, yep, teenage boy, stepmother, was always going to be a bit awkward. But later his wife became one of her ladies-in-waiting, so they probably rubbed along all right in the end. And she and John Latimer were married for quite a few years, and again, we don't know about their personal relationship, other than that he seems to have trusted in her, and he left the direction of his daughter to her in his will. But the big event of the 1530s, when Catherine was keeping house in the country at Snape Castle, which was Latimer's home, was the Pilgrimage of Grace, which the whole of the north of England erupted into rebellion. And Latimer, like many of the other gentry, was semi-forced into taking part. Now, her old father-in-law, Sir Thomas Burgh, had resisted being involved because he was a strong reformer. But Latimer was probably most historians think he was of a very conservative, traditional Catholic bent. Dr. Starkey has pointed out that he had betrothed his daughter Margaret to a reformer. So again, perhaps not quite so clear-cut as we might think. But Catherine had a really hard time in that Snape Castle, where she was with her stepchildren, was attacked by the rebels, and they broke into the castle and sacked part of it. Now, we don't know whether Catherine and Margaret were harmed. I mean, it's not impossible. Soldiers, you know, have attacked women for a very long time. But the Pilgrimage of Grace, they did see themselves as pilgrims of Christ, and they did sign an agreement that they would treat people, you know, that they wouldn't violate women. And so hopefully she wasn't subject to any personal violence.
Mm-hmm.
She certainly doesn't mention it in any of her writings or give any suggestion that that was the case, fortunately. But it must have been terrifying. And then, of course, Latimer was in a difficult position because he'd got involved with the rebels. The place had been, but his house had been ransacked by them. And, of course, King Henry and Cromwell were eyeing him with great suspicion because they thought he was involved. So he sort of was between a rock and a hard place to a degree. And it transpired he more or less had to leave the north. So he and Catherine moved down to the south of England, and they probably spent their time largely in Worcestershire with his brother, Marmaduke, marvellous name, and with her cousins who were all round Northamptonshire, the Vaux of Harrowden. And for those people who've been watching the Gunpowder Plot, the Vaux of Harrowden, who were, important characters in the story of the Gunpowder Plot, they were Catherine's cousins, the Vaux family. Mm. But of course, in those days, everybody was everybody's cousin. In 1542, there was a Parliament called, and Lord Latimer, of course, as a Baron of Parliament, was called to London to take part. He fell ill, and Catherine seems to have spent quite a lot of time at the court, in the household, possibly as a paid member, but possibly just a visitor of Henry VIII's daughter, the Lady Mary. Catherine's sister, Anne Harbert, was in Mary's household. And while she was there, she caught the king's eye. Yeah. But of course, she had already, because Latimer died in March 1543, she was already contemplating marrying somebody else altogether, Thomas Seymour. Yes. So Thomas Seymour was the brother of Queen Jane Seymour. And oddly, even though he was well into his 30s by now, he had never married, or at least there is no record of him ever having married, which was extremely unusual in those days.
Mm-hmm.
No record even of any broken engagements. There was talk of him marrying Mary Fitzroy, the widow of the Duke of Richmond, but she wasn't interested. Mm-hmm. Probably thought he was too low in birth for her. So, yeah, it's surprising that he'd never married. But he and Catherine seemed to have, been planning to marry when Henry came along and suggested the position of sixth wife.
Yeah, and she couldn't really say no to that.
Tricky, isn't it? What are you going to say? Yeah, so sorry, Your Majesty, but I really don't fancy you. It's not a winner, is it?
So then Thomas Seymour got sent away, right? And she became Henry's wife. And I'm really interested in kind of how she grew into that role and then her writing career, because that's a very, very big part of who she was being the first published woman writing her Lamentations of a Sinner and all of that. Can you tell me, I guess the first part is how she kind of grew into the role of a reluctant queen, I suppose.
I think in some ways she probably wasn't as reluctant as all that. I mean, clearly she seems to have been sorry not to marry Seymour, but you know, this was an age when a woman's duty was to promote her family.
Yeah.
She could do nothing better than be queen. It was a fantastic opportunity for her family. Her brother, who had been very unhappily married, managed to retain his wife's title and lands, but not have to live with his wife. It was great for him. Yeah, that's cool. Her sister's husband, he was already doing quite well, but it was very good for her whole family. It was a marvelous thing to be a queen. Henry, I know, you know, who would want to be married to Henry VIII, but he you've got to remember that he was considered to be a very charming man in his youth, and clearly he had charisma and people, you know, so perhaps, you know, wasn't quite as, you know, and he'd have had all the charisma of being a king. It probably wasn't quite as, you know, and power, everybody likes a bit of power, and she had all the money she could desire, all the jewellery she could want. Henry seems to have doted on her. He gave her lots of presents, and he clearly trusted her political judgment. She was
in between trying to kill her, right? Thinking about killing her.
Well, yes and no, but did he? So he appointed her as regent in 1544, and that all went very, very smoothly. But then, yeah, possibly it did go to her head a bit, and she became a little bit more, what should we say, lippy than Henry was entirely pleased with in a wife. Mm-hmm. Because she, whether she'd been interested in religious reform before or not isn't certain, but now she certainly became interested in it. And Henry, of course, had always been interested in theological debate, and they started to debate about it. And Catherine obviously failed to mention that she was, hanging on his every word and possibly contradicted him a few times. And, you know, that didn't go down too well. In the wider court, there was jostling between the reformist faction led by the Seymours, more or less, and the conservative faction led by Bishop Gardiner of Winchester, Sir Richard Rich, the Howards. So Catherine, once she'd annoyed the king, it suddenly seemed like a good idea to the conservatives they thought they might be able to get rid of her. Now, we've got to bear in mind that all of this comes from John Fox's Book of Martyrs. Mm-hmm. He tells a story where Catherine irritated the king. Gardiner leapt on it and said, you know, it's a fine thing when wives start telling husbands what to do. And Henry, always a bit sensitive about that, decided that Catherine was behaving badly. And Gardiner said that he would prove to Henry that she was a heretic. Mm. So Henry said, okay, fine, do your worst. But then Catherine found out that there was a plan to arrest her. Well, she probably found out from one of Henry's doctors. So it's certainly possible he let her know, in the same way that when the conservative faction attacked Cranmer, he managed to let them have their way to a degree, but then turned tables on them.
Yeah.
And put Cranmer at the head of the investigation into his own heresy. So it was, So it's possible that this was meant as a warning shot to Catherine rather than intention. Though,
so did it really happen, the dramatic scene where they were coming to arrest her and he kind of then yelled at the guards not to arrest her, even though he had said that it was okay earlier, like that famous scene that you hear about, did that really happen?
We don't know. Well, probably. I mean, say this is, it all comes from John Fox's Book of Martyrs.
Right.
Now, most scholars think that where his accounts can be tested, he's accurate. But we do have to remember that he had an agenda to show that, you know, Protestants and reformers were badly treated. So, but it probably did. Yes. I mean, his is the only account of it. There's no corroborating account, but I think it's very likely because it's similar to what happened to Cranmer. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But Catherine must have had a heart in the mouth, because when she saw them coming, she must have thought, oh.
Yeah. So then what, can you tell me a little bit about her writing and that side of her?
She was obviously of an intellectual turn of mind. We don't know the details of her education. She was educated as women were in, you know, she read, she wrote, she spoke French, she played musical instruments, she knew how to run a great household. Whether she learnt Latin in her youth is questioned. She certainly was learning it once she was Henry's wife, because from a diplomatic point of view, it was useful to know. And she also studied Spanish and Italian later in life. So she was clearly of a studious bent. Her first writings were some prayers, which she created, a prayer for people to say when Henry was abroad in France. So that was very positive. Then she translated some works by quite traditional theological works, like The Imitation of Christ, which had been, you know, the runaway bestseller of the 15th century. She also translated some works of Bishop of Rochester. Again, not, you know, fairly conservative stuff, not the sort of thing to make Henry's eyebrows rise in any way. Her other work, The Lamentations of a Sinner, which I have to say is, I did try sort of reading some of it, but just to give you a little flavour of it. So she talks about her journey from being mired in, quote, foul, wicked, perverse and crooked ways. Mm-hmm. And then she utterly rejects the Bishop of Rome as a persecutor of the gospel and a graver, setter forth of all superstition and counterfeit holiness.
Oh, wow.
And she bewails the miserable ignorance and blindness of men. So quite prolix, I think, is the word.
Yeah.
So that was The Lamentations of a Sinner, which she wrote probably during Henry's reign, but it wasn't published until the reign of her stepson, And after that, oh, she was also very closely involved in the translation of Erasmus's paraphrases on the gospel, which was a project by Nicholas Udall or Udall, never quite sure how to say that, which involved her stepdaughter, the Lady Mary, who did one of the paraphrases. It's unlikely that Catherine did any of the translation because her Latin wouldn't have been of sufficient level. But it was, she did promote the work and sponsor it. She doesn't seem to have written anything after Henry died other than the Lamentations of a Sinner, or completing that. And it's possible that a new life with a new husband and new interests may have taken her mind in more secular avenues than being married to Henry did.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit about the time she spent after the scare, as it were, and how her relationship with Henry was towards the end?
After that, again, he seems to have reverted to, doting on her, and he was generous to her. And she obviously, having had a scare, was very careful in her ways and perhaps became a bit more of the submissive, obedient wife that he thought she should be. In late 1546, he fell into some sort of a depression, and he probably didn't see Catherine. She didn't spend that Christmas with him, and there's no evidence that she was with him at the time of his death. Where possibly he had lost some faith in her is that although in 1544, when he went to France, she was appointed as regent, and in his will of that year, she was appointed to be regent for Edward should he die. In his final will, she wasn't named as regent. He provided very generously for her and wanted her to continue to be treated as queen, but she was given no political power.
And that led to like a fight, wasn't it? There was some drama with...
Oh, yes, with her sister-in-law. Now, her sister-in-law, Anne Stanhope, was married to Edward Seymour. So Henry died and Catherine lost no time, it has to be said, in remarrying. So Henry died towards the end of January, and sometime in May, she secretly married Thomas Seymour, which Thomas Seymour's brother, Edward, was in theory only one amongst the Regency Council, but within days of Henry's death, he was kingpin, he was Duke of Somerset, leader of the council, and king in all but name. Thomas was very upset about this because he felt he should have some share of the goodies that were being handed out, but he didn't get very much. And Edward Seymour, Duke of Somerset now, his wife, Anne Stanhope, had previously been one of Catherine's ladies-in-waiting, and she too was a firm Protestant by now, a reformer. But whether they'd quarrelled previously or whether they'd never liked each other, they certainly fell out now because the Duchess of Somerset felt she should take precedence as the protector's wife. And Catherine was saying, no, 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 I'm still the queen. And Anne Somerset was saying, no, no, you're just the wife of my younger brother, of my, you know, my younger brother-in-law. And these things really mattered in those days. Yeah. So Anne Somerset is jostling Catherine out of doorways, try and take first place. And the Duke of Somerset is withholding Catherine's jewels. So there's a big, family brouhaha.
Christmas dinner was awkward that year.
Yes, it probably was. Yeah. Yes. And Catherine had also upset her daughter and her stepdaughter, Mary, by her rapid marriage to Thomas Seymour, which Mary thought was disrespectful to the memory of her father. Yes.
So what that brings me into, what was her relationship like with Mary and with Elizabeth? Elizabeth was in the household. There's drama to get into too. There's so much drama.
So much drama, yeah. Catherine and Mary had been very good friends. So there's no looking at their relationship, and obviously it's an area I've looked at quite a lot for my book about Mary. They were good friends before Catherine became queen.
Religiously, they were still close, weren't they?
They were, because again, we've got to be careful not to look back. During Henry's life, Catherine, and right up until, it wasn't until certainly the 1549 prayer book, which was 2 years after Henry's death, and even the central point of religion, the Mass, was changed. Throughout Henry's life, there was nothing in day-to-day religious observance that Catherine and Mary didn't share, whatever might have been going on in their respective heads. So, yeah, we've got to be careful not to to look back and I mean, whether Mary'd ever seen the Lamentations of a Sinner in draft, you know, it didn't come out until after Henry's death. So, you know, they were on good terms.
Yeah.
And Mary lived with her, and they were, you know, seen together, and ambassadors would visit them together, and you know, they were close friends. Elizabeth was much younger. I mean, Mary was 4 years younger than Catherine. Elizabeth was 20 plus years younger. So she really was like her daughter. And she came to live with her. And Elizabeth was 13 and a half. And there she was with a stepfather who, Thomas Seymour, who took more of an interest in her than he should have done. Yeah. Again, you've got to be careful here to remember that, you know, as 12 was marriageable age in those days.
Right.
They didn't think of it the way we do. Now, clearly, there's, you know, the outrage was more about him obviously being unfaithful, or potentially, I'm sure he and Elizabeth never actually committed adultery or anything like that. But she was, you know, she was a marriageable age. But it was more the outrage of him, you know, laying his hands on the king's daughter that was horrifying everybody, rather than necessarily an age thing.
Right. Sure. And so what's the record? I mean, she sent Elizabeth away then, and then she was pregnant at this time too. Right. And like, kind of, did they ever repair their relationship?
Not in the flesh. So, I mean, it started off with Thomas Seymour, too much horseplay with his stepdaughter, you know, slapping and tickling and that sort of thing, going into her bedroom early. And to begin with, Catherine appears not to have known about it. When Elizabeth's governess, Mrs. Astley, you know, brought it to the Queen's attention, then Catherine thought, okay, well, she started to take part as well to make it all seem a bit more family friendly.
Right.
But allegedly, and again, you know, we can't ever know these things, she caught Thomas and Elizabeth embracing and possibly kissing. So she sent Elizabeth away, much as anything, to protect Elizabeth's reputation, because if Elizabeth had been shown to have had a physical relationship with a man, she would have lost her place in the succession. No possibility she could have been queen if she'd been known to have an affair with Seymour. And of course, if Catherine had allowed it to go under her roof, it's possible that she would have been punished as well. So she sent Elizabeth off. Sorry.
No. So she sent Elizabeth off, and then in her pregnancy was that, and
fairly early on. So she must have been maybe 3 or 4 months. Okay. You know, so she was pregnant, but she wasn't sort of right at the end. And Elizabeth obviously understood that her stepmother had done it for her own good, and she wrote a letter of thanks to Catherine saying, I know you spoke very frankly to me, but I appreciate it, because I know you wouldn't have done that if you didn't really care about me, or in Tudor sure. words to that effect. And then Elizabeth stayed in Cheshunt with the Denny family, and Catherine then went, I think in May or June of 1548, to Sudley Castle, and she took with her the young Jane Grey. And all seemed to be going swimmingly. She didn't seem to have had a difficult pregnancy. She seems to have made it up with Seymour, who, you know, probably persuaded her that it was all, you know, nothing but fun and games, and probably she wanted to believe that. And then poor Catherine died of puerperal fever, childbed fever.
Yeah.
Very, without having seen Elizabeth or Mary again, although they had both written to her.
Yeah, and then her child, isn't there a bit of a mystery about whether she died, if there's like a grave that's maybe hers can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the research, Dr. Porter did quite a lot of research into it, and I would definitely agree with her conclusions that Mary Seymour died young. I mean, what's quite upsetting about the poor little girl is she, first of all, of course, you know, her father was there to look after her. But within months of Catherine's death, Thomas Seymour was executed for treason. And the little girl, I mean, you would have thought that Catherine's brother or sister would have taken their niece. You know, Catherine had been very good to her siblings, but no. She went off to live with Catherine Willoughby, the Dowager Duchess of Suffolk, who had been one of Catherine's Rose's friends. But a year or two later, there's a letter from Catherine Willoughby complaining about the expense. The council made an order for some money, and then nothing is ever heard of her again.
Mm.
So I tend to think she must have died, because apart from anything else, it's likely that had she still been living when either Mary or Elizabeth came to the throne, that they'd have done something for her, I would have thought.
Sure.
Particularly Mary, who had, it's certainly likely that Mary Seymour may have been named for her. Sure. So, yeah, poor little girl. Yeah, I know. So she probably died at the age. I mean, a lot of children did.
Yeah. So what's kind of the takeaway that you have of Catherine and her life? What should we remember her for?
Yeah, I think actually she was somebody who, well, I really like her sort of intellectual curiosity. She clearly was somebody who was interested in different things and liked to learn. And she seems to have made friends wherever she went. All her stepchildren, possible exception of her older stepson, seem to have been very attached to her. Henry was attached to her. Other than the quarrel with Anne Somerset, which is actually quite fun, because Catherine writes about how she calls her a hell, which was fine to say that now, but in those days it meant something really, really bad. So she sort of comes to life with her in her letters to Thomas Seymour. She's somebody probably of Henry's wives, perhaps her and Anne of Cleves would be the most likely you'd want to be friends with, I think.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The most sort of fun without overdoing it.
Fun. So where can we go to learn more about her?
Well, we have got quite a lot on about her on the Tudor Times site. The scholarly biography of her is by Dr. Susan James, and it is exhaustive. It covers absolutely everything. So if you want to know anything about Catherine, that's the place to go. If you want to see Catherine in the context of the court and the times and her relationships, Dr. Linda Porter's book, Catherine the Queen, is super, absolutely super. Elizabeth Norton, not probably so detailed as the other two, but slightly different take on it. Very strong on her relationship with Elizabeth. She pops up Agnes Strickland, the good old Lives of the Queens of England. She loves Catherine as the first Protestant queen.
Sure.
So she, and also because she was a relation, far, far distant of the Strickland family of Sizer Castle, where Catherine may have lived for a bit with her cousin. Mm-hmm. So always lovely. She pops up in all of the, Six Wives books. For a novel, Elizabeth Freemantle, her book, The Queen's Gambit, that's it. And interesting, the Sixth Wife by Susanna Dunn, which is very different from your usual type of historical fiction, and it's written in very modern language, which takes a bit of getting used to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, that is all really wonderful. I love hearing more detail to her story, and just like we talked about with your talk at the Tudor Summit about Mary, with nuance, like it's so easy to put these women into boxes, and Catherine is certainly one that gets put into the nursemaid box a lot, and there is so much more to her than that. So thank you for bringing her more to life.
Good. Well,
thanks again, Melita, for taking the time to talk to us more about Catherine Parr. For more information on her, go to tudortimes.co.uk or see the resources on the England Cast site at englandcast.com. Remember, if you like this show, the biggest way you can help it is to leave a review on iTunes or tell a friend about it. Seriously, talk to your friends about this show if they love the Tudors, right? They're missing out. The next episode in about a week is going to be about shopping in Tudor England. So if you're already tired of Christmas shopping, you could maybe take a break from real Christmas shopping and hear about what it was like to go shopping in the Tudor period. So that's coming up next, and then we'll be back with another Tudor Times Person of the Month. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for your listenership and for all your support. And I will talk with you again very soon. Bye-bye.
Blow, northern wind, send for baby sweating.